Boykoff, who's now at the University of Colorado Boulder, looked at how the U.S. media covered global warming over a long period of time. And we looked at 1988 through 2002, and we looked in particular at one of the marks of so-called good journalism, the idea of balance. And, you know, tell both sides of the story, all that kind of thing, as if there are only two sides, but hey, we'll leave that to the side for a sec. So tell both sides of the story. Well, we looked at media coverage of global warming over this time period in the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal, and New York Times, and we found that, in fact, more than half of the articles during this long time period gave balance to the idea that humans are causing global warming on one hand and humans are not causing global warming on the other hand. So they allowed equal space for skeptics to challenge the idea of that humans, anthropogenic climate change or global warming in particular. So it's not a pretty picture. And it goes down to the very norms that guide journalistic behavior. Now, we've seen improvement, actually, in media coverage of the issue of global warming since the time of our study. My brother did another study that looked at 2003, when there was only 37% of the articles were balanced, which is to say biased in favor of climate change deniers. By 2004, only 10% of the articles had this misguided balance. By 2005, it was down to 8%. By 2006, it was down to 3%. So they really fixed that problem in a large sense. But the terrain has shifted to other questions, some of them utterly ridiculous when you think about it. For instance, and we hear this all the time in the media, can we actually act in a meaningful way to stop global warming if it's going to affect our economy? When you step back and think about that for a second, it's totally outrageous. Yet that's where the media terrain has shifted. It's also shifted to questions of adaptation, and we should be thinking about how to adapt to climate change in addition to trying to mitigate what's going on with it. But if the whole conversation shifts to adaptation, that's a problem. It might be nice to be able to grow oranges in Oregon, but I don't want to do it. Now, the Oregonian, the other day, let us know that, fortunately, the national recession is over. I don't know if you realize that. Where's my job? I don't know. But today our panelists are going to complicate that oversimple assessment and do a critique of what the media are doing wrong. We'll talk about what the media are doing right. And I'm very pleased to introduce our three panelists for today. I'm going to introduce them all at once, and then we'll just go one after the other. Our first speaker will be Danny Schechter, the News Dissector. He's the founder and executive editor of Media Channel, an organization that's concerned with the political, cultural, and social aspects of the media, large and small. Media Channel exists to provide information and diverse perspectives and inspire debate, collaboration, action, and citizen engagement. He's been a broadcast journalist and print journalist and a super active speaker and writer on the issues surrounding the media. He's won numerous awards for his work. He worked for CNN, he worked for ABC, and other places as well. He's been honored with Emmy Awards, the George Polk Award, and honors from the National Association of Black Journalists. He's the author of several books, including Plunder, Investigating Our Economic Calamity and the Subprime Scandal, as well as a book that goes along with his film, Plunder, which he just was kind enough to do the world premiere preview right here a couple days ago. So we'll have Danny will speak first. Second, we will have David Barsamian. He's the award-winning founder and director of Alternative Radio, the independent weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. The one-hour program is broadcast on public radio stations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and other countries, and also right here on KABU, and I just heard it on OPB the other day. He's the winner of the Media Education Award, the ACLU's Upton Sinclair Award for Independent Journalism, the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Award, and many other awards. The Institute for Alternative Journalism named him one of its top 10 media heroes. He's author of numerous books with Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Iqbal Ahmad, Arundhati Roy, Tariq Ali, Edward Said. He's done innumerable interviews with these people over the year. His latest books are What We Say Goes with Noam Chomsky and Targeting Iran. And our third speaker will be Joanne Bowman. She co-hosts the local radio program Voices from the Edge on KABU. And she's a former Oregon State Legislator, current Executive Director of Oregon Action, and Chair of Portland Community Media. She's a longtime voice for Portland's underrepresented communities and a leader in the struggle against racial and economic injustice. So please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Good morning, everyone. I look at you with great envy because I see people in the audience drinking coffee while the speakers have been instructed to act in solidarity with people without food all over the world. I want to ask the television crew from CBS in the back to please not block the view of NBC. We're having a real conflict here in terms of media coverage. I do bring you this morning's Oregonian. I hope you've seen it. The lead story, Noam Chomsky lashes neoliberalism at Eco-Convergence Conference, questions Obama's administration. Here's another one. Anti-war march begins against Afghanistan war, first in nation here in Portland. Reading the wrong paper. I'm reading the newspaper from Caracas, Venezuela, not from Portland, Oregon. I'm sorry for that. Made a mistake. Clearly, media impacts our lives. We live, I would argue, in a mediocracy that's mediocre, but nevertheless, a media-driven culture where perception trumps information and understanding, where the latest news cycle and the whatever the last headline is dominates the discourse, where context and background are stripped, generally speaking, from the content of most coverage, where people who are asked 30 minutes after watching a newscast what the lead story was, and they can't tell you. They're asked for any background information on some of the principal people in the news, and they can't tell you. We're in a culture that provides information and then somehow neutralizes that information. We've heard a lot about weapons of mass destruction. I've made a film on weapons of mass deception. But we live really in a culture of weapons of mass distraction. And that means essentially that the medium in our culture today, which is dominant, sort of defines our culture today. And I'm talking now about Twitter. How many of you have Twitter accounts in this room? A handful. For those of you who don't know what it is, check it out. It's a medium where you can tell people where you are at any given time, but you have to do it with 150 characters. Excuse me, I have to send out a little communique. Standing at podium, still without coffee, 9:32. We're dealing today with some phenomena that's really quite significant. I tried to talk with Noam last night about it, but my question wasn't as compelling as the one about whether American foreign policy is Christ-like or not. I don't know if you heard that, sort of appropriate to the venue. We got into a discussion of Ezekiel. It was fascinating. In any event, we're in a situation today where the major media itself is experiencing the media crisis because the revenue model of most mainstream media has been undermined in part by the global financial crisis, in part by the errors, ignorance, and stupidity of the people running many of these media outlets. And as a result, there's been a wave of cutbacks, newspaper closings, bankruptcies, and a general sense of doom and gloom. I was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University, which is the, you know, nominally revered, you know, fellowship. Basically, you get paid not to work, which is always, which tends to beat working. And at this conference, journalists, mainstream journalists from across the country, turned it into what was really a wake. Their, in a sense, dreams of, and their sense of self-importance and their sense of direction were really frazzled, because none of them was sure that they would have a job or for how long. None of them were very happy about changes in their own newsrooms, which meant that they were working more and making less, that there were cutbacks, that their newspaper unions were being broken, that newspapers were being funded by private equity deals, which essentially were more about making institutions that were profitable than making institutions that were informative. We've seen over the years the merger of so many media organizations, but there was another merger that wasn't really called attention to, which is the merger of newsbiz and showbiz, the way in which entertainment values not only got into the news, but drove the news and still drive the news today, where the most flamboyant soundbite, the most extreme statement, the funeral of the biggest celebrity tends to dominate the news coverage. And when you speak to people, what's very interesting is that when you speak to younger people, they accept this situation as normal because this is the only situation that they've known. They didn't grow up in the sense of expectation that the news business would be anything else, that there could be a Edward R. Murrow, that there could be even an I.F. Stone. They're in a period of kind of amnesia about the past, and that's part of what the media creates. And this is a problem across the spectrum. It affects everybody. Here in today's column, David Brooks of the New York Times, writing his syndicated column, which seems to have replaced the Chomsky column or the Barsamian column in the Oregonian, notes, he says, the rise of Beck, Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, and the rest has correlated almost perfectly with the decline of the Republican Party. But it's not because the talk jocks have real power. It's because they have illusory power, because Republicans hear the media mythology and fall for it every time. And the Republicans are not alone in that respect. Democrats also define their importance by getting their sound bites on the air. And there's a tremendous sport within the various new media monitoring groups who seem to specialize in finding, you know, the most outrageous comment by Bill O'Reilly of the day and, you know, bringing you that video from YouTube, you know, to out, isn't this awful, to outrage us even more. Did you hear what Glenn Beck said last night? Oh my, you know, and so we ourselves on the progressive side of the spectrum are consumed by monitoring the idiocies of these people on the airwaves. And you know what? They are happy about it. And you know why? Because the more the liberals hate Bill O'Reilly, the bigger his salary is. He goes back to Fox News and say, look how effective I am. I'm disturbing the people from Reclaim the Media in Washington State. They're infuriated by what I'm saying. Isn't that great? So in other words, we're sort of playing into this very conscious effort to build market share by the use of heat, not light. And that's what's happening in our media system. I know it well because I worked inside CNN. I was part of the startup team. I worked at ABC News for 8 years. I worked at CNBC. I've sort of been on the inside. I went from an outsider to an insider, happily to an outsider again. I became, in the words of the New York Daily News, the hero of downward mobility because of this particular, chronology. And now I'm trying with my company, Global Vision, to try to offer a counter-narrative to what's in the news. I write a blog every morning on mediachannel.org, the News Dissector blog. I was known in Boston as Danny Schechter, the News Dissector. I didn't get a chance to remind Noam Chomsky, but I had been on the job a week, and he basically almost got me fired for pointing out that I shouldn't use the word Viet Cong in my broadcasts during the Vietnam War, because it was a derogatory phrase, and that I should use National Liberation Front, which I did, and was called into the manager's office and basically given my walking papers until I gave him a letter from the National Labor Relations Board indicating that we had organized our station into the United Electrical Workers, and I was the shop steward. So he wasn't able to fire me the way he wanted to, and we stayed on the air, and I stayed on the air for almost 10 years in Boston, with Noam occasionally commenting on the news on my program. But the main point was the program was very popular. People want to be informed. They want to know what's going on. Look around this church yesterday at the lines, waiting in line for Noam Chomsky. I was very amused when somebody gave me a flyer on the will call line last night. And he said, oh, take this flyer. I said, but I'm not from Portland. I probably can't go to the event. He said, that's okay. You can use the back to take notes on Noam's talk. Okay. So clearly, we're in a situation of what he was talking about last night, this democratic deficit, where people want one thing and we're being given another thing. People want information. They want to know what's going on. Their lives, in many cases, depend on it, rely on it, and at the same time, we're not really being well informed. And this is particularly true when it comes to the financial crisis. And I want to talk about that for a minute, because in 2005, after doing the film WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, which argued that the war in Iraq was brought about in large part by our media itself, which sold the war in the guise of reporting on it. And I had a lot of examples, showed how the media system was geared around what was called millietainment, essentially turning the war into an entertainment spectacle with, you know, larger-than-life heroes and larger-than-life devils, in the case of Saddam Hussein. Saddam, Saddam, evil, evil. You remember that. But I had a problem, because most of the anti-war movement would march on Washington and yell at President Bush outside the White House. But no one would march on the Washington Post, which was 10 blocks away, which was creating the climate for the war itself, that the left itself didn't really get the change in our society from a country that was, in a sense, dominated by an elected government to a country that is dominated by an unelected corporate elite, of which the media is the front page, the front, institution that interfaces with the public. And so, as a consequence, my call for let's put the heat on the media for what they're doing went nowhere. And part of it was because even people who were sophisticated were watching the right-wing media, which had a very small audience, what Rush Limbaugh was saying, and they were ignoring the mainstream media, which actually had a large audience and which was engaging in very effective propaganda. When after that film, I decided, let's take an issue that maybe can bring people together, that could try to end the polarization in America. And I, you know, looked at what would that issue be? What's something that unites us all? What's the issue that could bring across the racial divides and the generational divide in America? And the issue I came up with was debt. And the film I made was In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Bursts. And the film warned of a coming credit crisis and an economic disaster. And for my effort, I was basically told that this film, unlike so many others that I made, would not get on the air, which it didn't, except on Link TV and Free Speech TV and a few other outlets, even though it was shown in 40 countries around the world. And I was called a doom and gloomer. I was called an alarmist for raising this question. And again, I was greeted with hostility among the people in the know, the so-called business media press, which itself had ignored the coming of the crisis, did not investigate it, did not warn us about it, did not really hold the banks and the institutions that were speculating in such a massive way and creating this crisis. They were not the focus. Instead, media institutions between 2002 and 2007 took in $3 billion in advertising from dodgy lenders and credit card companies. Nobody on the left, by and large, was even relating to this issue. After all, we were in the middle of a political election, and you know, we were dealing with the Obama campaign, not in terms of the money at the grassroots level, but we weren't paying attention to the bundling going on among people on Wall Street who were helping to fund that campaign. That wasn't really covered very much. And as a consequence, this whole kind of crisis snuck up on many people. Many people believed that if I do not have investments in the stock market, this is not going to affect me. I somehow live outside the economy, the real economy. I'm not connected to this in any way until we woke up one morning and found and are finding 14 million families losing their homes, the latest unemployment statistics, 9.8 officially, 20 or more unofficially, that our whole country, that Portland is the second largest unemployment in the country. I drove here this morning and saw not the usual homeless people that one sees in New York, but young people living in, on the streets here, and I think in every city in America, can't find jobs. Young law students graduating from college can't find jobs. The pain of American people not really being reported. I know I'm going to finish right now. So this is an issue that I'm trying to write about. I've written a book called The Crime of Our Time. Never have so few done so much to so many. And this is a look at the financial crisis as a crime story. And I've done a film called Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, which has not gotten the support, and unfortunately, that Michael Moore's wonderful film has. But we showed it here on Thursday night. People seem to like it, and we're trying to get it seen again today. And so this will be added to the program if we can find a place to show it. But it's a film that goes into this whole crime question, and I welcome you seeing it. Thank you for hearing part of my critique this morning, because I just started basically critiquing not the mainstream media for its failures, but the left and the progressive movement for our failures to make media a major issue on our agenda. Thank you.
Comrades, good morning. It's great to see you, and it's wonderful to be back in Portland. It's kind of a home away from home. I'm based in Boulder. Many of you may hear alternative radio on K-Boo. Not America's most scariest radio station, but one of the best community radio stations in the country. Alternative radio, so that's on Tuesday mornings at 9, and occasionally KOPB airs the program Tuesday evenings at 8. For those of you in the Eugene area, sorry for this commercial, KLCC Tuesday evenings at 6:30. Out on the coast, Astoria, K-Moon, another great call letters. The three of the most interesting call letters for radio stations are actually right around here. There's Chaos in Olympia, right? Well, you have to wonder when they're doing their fundraising drives, give money to Chaos. Yes, yes. I mean, it has a certain anarchistic, flavor to it. Then you have K-Boo here and K-Moon out in Astoria. I want to thank Jules Boykoff and all the great people that have made this conference happen. And I think what is really crucial is the action component of it, rather than the, you know, theoretical meanderings and rehearsals of some things which may be rather obvious to most of you. You know, what is it? What is that Paulito, as we say in southwestern Spanish? What is that spark that is going to ignite a kind of leftist bonfire? I mean, we're, you know, getting quite a few tea parties and the rantings and ravings of Goebbels TV, also known as Fox. You know, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, actually. I don't feel it's any kind of intellectual virtue to critique Beck and Hannity and all the rest, people like Ann Coulter, Michelle Malkin. I mean, they're pretty easy targets. It's much more difficult to talk about, let's say, Mark Shields on the Snooze Hour with Jim Lehrer. You know, arguably the most boring program in all of broadcasting, public as well as commercial. And the bar is very high when I say boring. You know, for those of you who may listen to some interviews by Robert Siegel on Some Things Considered, the misnamed national public radio program, which does consider some things and does manage to leave out a huge amount. For example, any discussion about the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict is always framed in the traditional cliches and platitudes about the millennia-old hatreds of these people. It's interesting what's omitted, because most of the censorship is about omission rather than commission. And you can't talk about the Middle East without talking about H2O, water, and that's where I think the center of conflict is largely around water issues. The average Israeli uses four times the amount of water as the average Palestinian. Most of the settlements happen to be built, and I reject the term settlement as well. It's too benign. Let's call them colonies. That's what it is. It's a colonization and annexation project, and it's not, you know, brave settlers going off in the Palestinian West in their wagon trains, you know, settling wild areas. It's not all, you know, once you enter that lexical discourse, which is already, you know, planted basically by the media, as, you know, Danny says, in terms of so much of the framing, the argument's over. I mean, who can be against settlers and settlements? God, they just want to have a home, a roof over their heads. It sounds, you know, provide for their children. Are you against schools? Come on. You know. So, I mean, and so that's what it is. But rarely is it mentioned anywhere that the settlements are built, the colonies are built on the West Bank aquifer. And that is the big prize. The West Bank does not have oil. Gaza has neither oil nor water. It is one of the most, not only is it the world's largest open-air prison, it's perhaps one of the most water-stressed areas in the world as well. I just returned from Syria and Lebanon. What are people in Syria interested in? Well, I mean, they have major water issues as well, and this all relates to geopolitics and, you know, imperial intervention in the Middle East. Syria is another water-stressed area. And guess what? Israel is occupying the Golan Heights, which is an area that has an enormous amount of water. Not only is it occupying it, in 1981, it was formally annexed into Israel as part of the State of Israel. UN Security Council resolutions were passed condemning the annexation. And you know the rest. Israel was, you know, suffered severe sanctions from the UN. It was invaded by a multinational force which sought to, enforce UN Security Council resolutions, as you know, as you would normally expect. And of course, it attracted the worldwide opprobrium as well. I was interested to see in the New York Times Sunday Magazine a couple of months ago a full-page ad inviting American tourists to visit Syria's Golan Heights. We truly live in the United States of amnesia, as Gore Vidal says. This is the USA. There's no memory whatsoever. You know, there is no memory of what happened in 1967 or 1981 beyond, again, these familiar tropes of, you know, Islam is some kind of fanatical religion that breeds hatred, unlike Christianity, let's say, We've got such a great record, particularly in the latter part of the 20th, mid and latter part of the 20th century. I and others wrote to the New York Times Magazine complaining about this little omission. You know, how could you run this full-page ad from the Israeli Tourist Board, visit the vineyards, drink the wine, come ski in winter, and then this is occupied territory. Why don't you perhaps have a little bar on the bottom of the full-page advertisement for which you get tens of thousands, if not $50,000. I don't know how much a full-page ad in the Sunday Times Magazine might run. And as you might expect, not one of these letters was printed by the newspaper of record. Now, I think water is a crucial environmental issue, but we also have to talk about the environmental detritus of imperial wars of aggression. Again, particularly in the Middle East, but also don't forget Somalia, a country that the United States routinely bombs whenever it targets what are called senior or high-level al-Qaeda officials. You'll notice, again, in the discourse that the people that the U.S. kills either in Pakistan or in Syria when it bombed Syria last year, again, hardly any comment about that. These people are always masterminds and architects and senior al-Qaeda leaders, special consultants with Osama bin Laden or Ayman Zawahiri. And, do they say that they may have targeted a receptionist or a phone operator or, just an ordinary citizen. It's always couched in these very dramatic, terms. And so it kind of excuses the whole operation. Imperial detritus in Iraq, of course, with depleted uranium from the first Gulf War. Afghanistan has been at war for virtually 30 consecutive years, and one can say the same about Iraq as well, since it invaded Iran in 1979, an invasion widely applauded by Henry Kissinger and other great Nobel Prize winners, the brilliant Thomas Friedman, three-time Pulitzer Prize winner of the New York Times, thought that was a great war. Let them just kill each other and wipe each other out. Iraq has enormous environmental problems. It is also, interestingly, the land of the great two rivers, the Euphrates and Tigris, is now one of the most water-stressed areas in the world. It's not for nothing a World Bank president a few years ago said that the wars of the 21st century are going to be about oil. They're not going to be about, the wars of the 21st century are going to be about water, not about oil. And the water issues are becoming extremely acute. And that ties in, of course, with global warming. I had my own personal, very dramatic experience. Last year, I trekked up to Gangotri. For those of you who've been in the Indian Himalayas, it's the source of the Ganges River. And it is a site where there was a very famous Hindu temple that was built there. The pilgrims went because, you know, Ma Ganga, the river that gives life, started there. Well, the glacier that was once there has now recessed some 20 plus miles from its original spot. And so there's much less water coming into the Ganges. The water levels are going down. What does that mean? There's less water for people to drink. There's less water for agriculture. Now, we're not talking about a small population base that benefits from the great rivers that originate in the Himalayas. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, the whole Gangetic Basin. Right out to the Bay of Bengal depends on water from the Ganges. And the size of, and this was, it was very moving to see this barren tundra where there was once a major glacier. And all of the glaciers in the Tibetan Plateau, which is about the size of Italy, are in recession. This includes the rivers that nourish China, the Yangtze, the Mekong in Southeast Asia that flows into Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, the Irrawaddy in Burma, and crucially, five of the major rivers that flow through Pakistan have their origins in the Indus Valley Basin from the glaciers in the Tibetan plateau. Again, this will be, I think, a major, major issue that needs our, I think, a very urgent attention. The slogan about you can't live without water, and nothing is more true than that. And I think there's been very little serious media coverage of these particular issues. Maud Barlow of the Council of Canadians, a brilliant woman, has been screaming at the top of her voice for years now to get people to focus on what's happening with water and the privatization of water. So not only is fresh water disappearing, in huge amounts, but we have this whole wave of, you know, Fiji water and all the rest that, you know, makes you feel good to think you're drinking natural waters from thousands of miles away by, you know, from companies owned, you know, that are basically, they're run by Pepsi and Coke and Evian and other major multinationals. So water is a huge issue in the Middle East. It's a huge issue in Afghanistan. Let me just maybe wind up remarks here. We're talking about Afghanistan and the huge escalation, change you can believe in, change you voted for on November 4th, change you cheered and applauded for when Barack Obama became the first African-American president sworn in on the 20th of January, 2009. Afghanistan has, again, huge environmental problems. It's enormously water stressed. Again, these issues are very rarely touched upon. And basically, U.S. foreign policy is very consistent from Bush to Obama to Reagan to Carter. The people of the areas where the empire extends its tentacles are simply extras on a Hollywood set in a drama written, you know, by Washington think tanks and pundits and then echoed in the corporate media. Afghans, who are Afghans? You think if you read The Kite Runner or watch Charlie Wilson's War, you have any understanding of Afghanistan? Please. The same thing with Pakistan. Everyone's asking me about Three Cups of Tea and Greg Mortensen. You know, these are not ways to understand other cultures. One has to live there. One has to have an appreciation and understanding for civilizations which have evolved along very different lines from, let's say, the United States, although I have problems connecting civilization and the United States in the same sentence. I wonder why that is. And so, you know, the Afghans, the Palestinians, the Iranians, whoever they may be, we know they're dark people, they move in the shadows, they speak funny languages that we can't understand. They even write backwards. I mean, what more do you need to know about how primitive they are? You know, they don't, you know, they don't share any of our values. And there was that New York Times headline just a few weeks ago, Afghans upset U.S. plans. How dare they? Imagine that, the arrogance of those bloody Afghans. Don't they know their place? I mean, this is the empire, after all. We have plans for Afghanistan. Might the Afghans have plans for their own country? Might Pakistanis have some vision of Pakistan? Of course not. This is the same old imperial mindset, albeit much more eloquently and with great articulation, you know, enunciated by Obama. But how is it different in fundamental ways from previous regimes? Regimes which were easy to loathe. Again, to criticize George W. Bush is, you know, is like talking about Hannity and O'Reilly and Beck. I mean, it's shooting fish in a barrel. It's much more difficult to talk, apparently, about Obama. And so what is he doing in Afghanistan? Just recently, doubling the number of troops, which will mean, what will that mean? A huge escalation in violence. There will be many more Afghans killed, many more Pakistanis killed in these assassinations by stealth aircraft called drones, which makes the United States, you know, extremely unpopular in Pakistan. Surprise, surprise. I've been there three times in the last year. I've been to Afghanistan before. And I can tell you that this policy is just engendering a new generation of jihadis, a new generation of resistance to Washington, and particularly Washington's arrogant behavior in believing that it has the answers to internal problems. We have to listen to their voices. I know that's not cool, but there's actually a woman in this country right now. I interviewed her in College Park, Maryland a few weeks ago. It's on my website, alternativeradio.org. She's a woman, a representative of the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. That's RAWA, RAWA.org. And, you know, in the course of the conversation, this is a very radical group of feminists, and you can imagine their situation in Afghanistan in terms of, misogyny and patriarchy and dealing with those issues. And I said, well, what do you want? You know, what is your organization advocating? She said, we want the Americans out. And acknowledging, and how quickly? Right away. We want all U.S. and NATO troops out of Afghanistan, and then, well, what will happen? I mean, won't there be, you know, a bloodbath and mass murder and killing? And she said, it's up to Afghans to decide our problems and to settle our problems using, you know, our processes and not having a largely, in this case, Christian and white imperial external force coming in and telling us what to do. So I think we need to listen to voices like Shekia Sazib, who was using actually a pseudonym and would not allow herself to be photographed or filmed because of the danger to her life. This organization, these women, they're putting their lives on the line. I think we should listen to them. So I want to thank you all for your attention, and I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Thank you.
Good morning. We're going to be able to do much better than that. You've had your coffee now, so we're going to try that once again. Good morning.
Good morning.
Much better. I want to thank Jules and the dozens of people who worked tirelessly for a year to bring this conference to Oregon. I want to also thank the fabulous Danny and Dave because, following these two guys, it's like, whew, so what do I say now? Thank you very much. It's been a great conference. No. I want to actually bring it back locally and actually give you some local examples of why we need to change how the media reports information to us. And you may remember over the summer, all across the country, there were all these town halls going on to talk about how we needed to reform our healthcare system in this country. Now, if you lived in Oregon and you got the Oregonian, what you would believe is that the people that came out were absolutely opposed to us fixing our healthcare system in this country. If you got the Oregonian, you would be led to believe that the only people who showed up and had a voice in these town hall meetings were people who didn't want the government involved in their healthcare. Now think about this. I mean, when you saw the pictures, you saw a pretty much elderly population, and I count myself among those, so don't take offense, anybody, right? But you saw a lot of gray-haired people going, I don't want the government involved in my health care. They have to leave my health care alone. And, you know, so you're left to think, well, okay, you don't want the government involved in your health care, then give back your Medicaid. Give back your Social Security, right? I mean, it's like, and so if you didn't go and really investigate, if you didn't go to blogs, if you didn't go online, if you didn't listen to Democracy Now! And other public radio venues, you would have been left with the impression that the government was trying to do this massive takeover of those poor insurance companies. And they were going to be put out of business because the government wanted to provide health care. The second biggest economic dilemma that we have in this country is our health care system. Other than payroll, health care is the biggest cost for any employer who actually wants to provide coverage, health coverage for their employee. But you would be led to believe that the teabaggers were in fact a grassroots organized effort that came from the ground up to reclaim their democracy. But you know, I'm a big fan of following the money. When people start telling me things that I don't believe, I start thinking, are these grassroots forces? Let's see. What we understand is that right-wing influence spent a lot of money this summer hiring organizers to go around the country and actually infiltrate these town hall meetings. In fact, they trained them, just like we did during the civil rights movement and churches, to go out and be disruptive forces in the community. Now, did they want to have a dialogue about really what's the best healthcare reform we can get? Did they want to say a single payer good? Should we have a public plan option? Or should we just, the current system works fine? No, they didn't want to have a conversation. What they wanted to do was bully, loud talk, and intimidate people into absolute silence. And guess what? We allow Main Street media to go out and pick the wackiest, craziest, insanest individual to put on the evening news, to write about in the newspaper, and tell us that this is how America feels about this issue. Now, I gotta ask you, why aren't we just outraged that they feed us this garbage? Why are we not saying, because of media consolidation, we're getting one perspective, and if you follow my philosophy about following the money, it doesn't take rocket science to figure out why they are giving us the perspective that they want us to swallow. If you follow the money, you know who's buying the advertisement for those media outlets. Who's investing the resources to make sure the perspective that you get is the perspective that they want you to have? The good news is that we're actually in a time in media where each and every one of you are an investigative reporter. You have a cell phone that probably has a camera on it. Guess what? That makes you an investigative reporter. Anybody can blog today about the issues that you care about. We talked about Twitter. We have the ability ourselves to reshape the public dialogue. When 3,000 people march downtown Portland and it doesn't make the Oregonian, there's something wrong with our traditional media outlet. I want to tell you a personal story. You'll get a kick out of this. Let me tell you how the media can frame a dialogue. Some of you may know that a couple of weeks ago I was up for a Senate appointment. And you know, when you're up for a Senate appointment, you know, you have to go through a Democratic nominating process. Then there's a county commission meeting. And so the nominating process selects three people that move forward to the county. Then the county commissioners pick one person out of that three-person group. Imagine my surprise the morning that I'm about to go in front of the county commissioners and I pick up the Oregonian and I find out that there's an endorsement for the seat that I'm seeking. I'm thinking, did I miss a phone call? Did I miss that email? The endorsement gave this rave review of one of the three that were up for this particular seat. It wasn't me, by the way. And they did mention me way, way, way down in the article. And they had two sentences to describe who I was. They said, Bowman, a social worker activist who works for a social service agency, is a disruptive force and should not be appointed to this seat. Now, you can think what you want about whether or not I'm a disruptive force, but I've never been a social worker. I've never worked for a social service organization. And whether you love or hate me, you know exactly where I stand. Now, this is supposedly the major media paper in Oregon. They didn't call me. Now, you would think a process for an endorsement interview would be to talk to all the candidates. And when challenged by a smaller media outlet, they said, well, after all, it was an opinion piece. We didn't have to talk to her. They said, but she wasn't a social worker. Well, so we got that wrong. No big deal. It was an opinion piece. And so if you can only give two sentences, and all two sentences are wrong? I say there's something wrong with our major media outlet in Oregon. But here's what you can do. I love that Danny said, why aren't we actually protesting outside our news outlet when we know that they are lying to us? Why aren't we staging massive protests to say, you lie? Why aren't we doing that? Because if we continue to allow them to get away with feeding us misinformation, if we continue to like just gobble it up and say, because what it does is it demoralizes us. It tells us there's nothing we can do because everybody's on this other side. But we know better because we're talking to people in our local community. We know better because we're in the trenches working to change this democracy. And if we allow them to get away with it, then they will continue to be misleading so many people in our community. It is our responsibility to, if they don't work, and actually I did cancel my subscription, and I encourage other people, when you start reading all this propaganda that they keep giving us, that you need to let them know when you cancel your subscription why you're canceling. And then we need to make sure that we're supporting community media, public access TV, Democracy Now, and the kind of programs that we know that people are doing because their heart's in it. Not because they're getting a lot of money, not because they're getting fame and fortune, but they're doing it because they want to make sure you have the best information possible so that you can act accordingly. So I think I'm going to stop because I think it's important for us to have a conversation about where do we move from here. I got to tell you, I'm on the other side of 50, and so when somebody first mentioned Twitter to me, I was like, huh? What? Is that a bird? What do you mean, right? But I realize if we're going to engage multi-generationally, cross-culturally, in a movement, we've got to use every single vehicle at our disposal. Do you know that Facebook can actually sign up 10,000 people in a week to be part of a group? That's the power we have of some of these new mediums that we should be taking full advantage of. So I thank you for your attention. I thank you for being here, and I look forward to your questions.
Okay, let's open it up for comments, questions. There is a mic up here, should you wish to use it. So your thoughts.
Well, to address the question about the media, I think efforts to, quote-unquote, improve the media is not a good use of our energy, time, and resources. I think we need to build our own media, and that's one of the exciting things that's been happening over the last 20 or 30 years with the growth of alternative radio, Global Vision, Democracy Now!, Big Noise Films. There's been a plethora of absolutely terrific documentaries that are being produced by very talented, mostly young people. These are very exciting developments, I think, that should be encouraged. Are the corporate media going to change their spots? Probably not. And here's some more good news. More and more young people, the corporate media are losing their eyeballs and their ears. They're not there. They're not reading the New York Times. I bought Newsweek the other day because it had a particularly outrageous cover about the mind of the Taliban, and it's been years since I bought Newsweek. It cost $6.41. I had sticker shock. Whoa, So they're losing readers and viewers in large numbers. I think this is very encouraging, and we need to be there. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Fly like a butterfly, sting like a bee, and have very creative alternatives because that's going to capture the minds of young people rather than the staid old, Charlie Rose show or Morning Edition, where everyone is very polite, thank you for being here, wonderful, thank you for inviting me, and nothing is said. It's completely vacuous. So I'm encouraged because young people have, figured it out, and there are, I think, terrific new ventures out there.
Speaking on the other side, challenging the views of my colleague and comrade here. In the same way that we can just say we ignore the government doesn't represent us, they're doing all these bad things, so let's just tune them out totally. I don't think that is a road to civic engagement and political awareness. We're not simply looking out for our own information needs. We're looking out for the needs of everyone in this country. And what we're trying to do in some ways is to make people more aware of what they're not getting, not simply what they are getting. By the way, I want to acknowledge the raging grandmas who are here, who were great last night. Also, my colleague from Reclaim the Media here from the state of Washington and probably others who I can't recognize because I never got that cup of coffee. Anyway, one little item here about the media, didn't cover you properly. OMG. How could they? When you read the Oregonian today, and there's a column by Paul Krugman, quite good, about mission not accomplished on the economic crisis. And then you go to the bottom, underneath the copyright, and it says, reach Paul Krugman at the New York Times, 229 West 43rd Street. Does anyone in the Oregonian know that the New York Times left that office several years ago and has a new building on 8th Avenue? They can't even get the address right of the New York Times. No wonder they're not covering you adequately. So I would just say, look, the fight about media is not just a fight for us to have our own outlets that we listen to religiously. Democracy Now, great outlet. But, you know, the problem here is that we have a very fragmented media marketplace, and everybody's targeting certain demographics. And as a result, the idea of the national audience for news and information has been lost. If you watch network news, who watches network news? Well, I can tell you how to find out. Look at the ads. Who are the ads targeting? And they're targeting, you know, folks like me in the Viagra generation. So, you know, tell your doctor to give you the purple pill this week, you know. You know, that's a clear sign of who actually is watching the newscast. Of course, young people aren't. You know, they're dreadfully boring and poorly done. At the same time, those people who are out there at those town meetings, I don't want the government messing with my Medicare. Hello? Isn't Medicare a government program? Never mind. You know, the point is that those people are not being informed very well either by this media system. Many of them don't want to be informed, clearly. But if we're concerned about a democracy is based to some degree on people making informed choices. And in order for them to make informed choices, that's why our media is here. It's not just here as a private enterprise. It's here as a constitutional mandate. You know, freedom of the press, the media industry has a constitutional protection because it was seen as an important part of our democracy to have some checks and balances, to have some accountability, to have a fourth estate. Now, that's completely compromised and corrupted, no question. But without it, what do we end up with? You know, our own media, you know, me TV, you know, what I'm watching, you know, and is satisfying me. And unfortunately, you know, this is a big problem. If you watch PBS, you know, comes the frequent fundraising period, and what's on? Peter, Paul, and Mary, Bob Dylan, you know, it's all geared to progressive donors. When you watch the ordinary programming, what's on? It's all geared to people in Washington, D.C. think tanks. And the people, the constituency, is not well served. So this is why I think media is an important issue. I'm very, you know, excited by independent efforts, alternative media, and the like. I'm part of it. I make films. I write a blog. I'm trying to promote that spirit. But at the same time, I think you have to be mindful and be willing to demand responsibility and accountability by mainstream and major media.